Welcome to the podcast. This is the next episode of our second season, and today we have a very special guest, Miłosz Wiatrowski-Bujacz. Welcome.
Hello.
My name is Ewa Pospieszyńska, and my co-host is...
Anna Oppenheim. Hello.
And we are very excited about today's theme. We'll be talking about solidarity movement, Solidarność, and we are trying to position it in a very specific context of Poland during communism, but also we will definitely try to draw those links with what can we learn from solidarity movement today. And I suppose before we introduce Miłosz properly, it would be good for me and Anna to actually tell something about ourselves, because we haven't done a proper introduction for a while, and we might have some new listeners. I'm Ewa Pospieszyńska. I grew up in Gostynin, which is a small town in central Poland, and I moved to the UK in 2016 to study here, and I stayed since then, with a little break during the pandemic when I was very much involved in the protest around abortion ban by our lovely Constitutional Court and Law and Justice Party. I'm very much involved on a broadly understood left, working with organizations such as Labour Campaign for Free Movement, which is especially concerned with exposing the violence of the border system. And I'm also a member of a left-wing Polish party called Razem, which also has a branch in London, in which we organize with Anna. And my day job is actually in book publishing, because I read a lot, especially political theory. Anna, can you please introduce yourself as well?
Hello, everyone. My name is Anna. I grew up in Warsaw, but I've spent the past 11 years living in London. I work in the UK Parliament for a left-wing MP. And for a long time, I've been very involved in British politics, on the left of the Labour Party and organizing for migrants' rights. But in recent years, I've been getting more and more active in the progressive Polish community here in London, and I'm a member of Razem International.
So much more succinct. You can tell that Anna is great with Twitter and I'm not. Anyways, it's time to introduce our guest. So let me maybe start and then I'll give you the floor. Miłosz is a historian and also academic generally, interested in economy and also ideas of history. So how the social thought changes over time. He's a PhD candidate at Yale, but also a journalist and a very famous Instagrammer. We are very happy to have you today.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here. Yeah, so I'm an economist, actually. Mm-hmm. And so my background was, I was very neoliberal, very kind of mainstream economics. I did my undergrad at Sciences Po, and then, you know, my dream was to work for international finance organizations or like the general kind of world of, international consulting. So I had an internship at the World Bank, then I was working as a consultant at the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. So it was kind of very mainstream, almost like globalist, right? Or the global nomads, global kind of upper middle class of people who are shaping the world. And
honestly, I would not tell that this is your background.
Yeah, so and I was always very interested in development economics, and so that was very tied to my Polish background, because I was kind of a child of a golden child of post 89. My dad was an entrepreneur. He had a well functioning company. He was firmly very kind of gung-ho and positive about the transition to free market. He was super kind of pro free market, and I was like that as well. And so I was kind of both felt like there are lessons from the Polish transition that can be applied elsewhere. And also I was very curious about why Polish transition, that, you know, in my head was a huge absolute success, has met such a big backlash in Poland, both mm-hmm. immediately in the 90s and kind of mid 90s, and also, you know, over the last, I mean, that was in 2008, 2009, some kind of, you know, the Law and Justice one in 2005, on this kind of slogans about how Poland has to be not liberal, but more kind of social And so I was always wondering about why do we keep working against our biggest successes and so on, and how can like the Polish story of transition to free market can be applied in sub-Saharan Africa and the global south. And so that was the origin story.
Wow, you've moved quite a long way. So can you explain a little bit about like your PhD currently?
My PhD is kind of still very much in the same department. It's still about Polish transition from command economy to free market economy. But now I'm focused more on how is it possible for a government or a movement that was that originated with solidarity with a trade union, with a huge movement that was protesting against the increasing quality of life and in favor of higher wages, how that movement produced a government and a kind of political milieu that already in 1989 very, very strongly embraced neoliberalism and kind of free market dogmatism. And not only that, but kind of kept within this, kept to this camp, kept those beliefs until right now. Polish elites are, I would say, much more neoliberal still than the kind of global shifts that we have seen over the last half a decade.
Which I guess brings me to my first question, because before we go back to history, I want to ask broadly, like, what is the legacy of Solidarność in Poland today? Like, why is this topic relevant?
Right. So there's a quote I like very much from a French historian, François Furet, and he wrote a history of kind of Bolshevism and socialism of Russian Revolution and Soviet Union and so on from intellectual history. He published it I think in 1994, and he started the book with the sentence "Lenin ne laisse pas d'héritage." Lenin doesn't leave he didn't leave any legacy, and that was already essentially 2 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. And since he's was a French historian, that was kind of in contrast to the French Revolution, that basically still every 10 years or every 20 years we have this discussion in France, but not only, like, do we still live through the consequences of the French Revolution? I think there was a debate in France like 10 years ago, like, are we still in the midst of the French Revolution? Mm-hmm. And in a kind of to counter that, Furet said, well, actually, when you compare French Revolution to the Russian Revolution, like, there is no heritage whatsoever, no legacy, like, mm-hmm. two years after that. And I kind of feel like it's very similar with solidarity and Solidarność in Poland. So we tend to still reference it a lot, and a lot of political camps from all across the aisle, try to say we are the ones who are continuing the legacy of solidarity.
Everyone wants to claim it for themselves.
But it's fully empty in terms of substance. Like, it means nothing. We other than the fact that yes, there was a huge social movement in Poland, and it was super successful up to the point, and it was a huge moment of social mobilization. Mobilization towards what? What did it mean? We don't really talk about it. There is no public holiday or any sort of commemoration that would kind of reunite us with this, with talking about solidarity and what it meant. There's none of that. Yeah. And so I kind of feel like, even though it's very often mentioned, as we said, it is devoid of meaning. It's a completely empty term.
And I think that's why also we wanted to speak about it today, because we were like, okay, so much of Polish politics these days is actually determined by what happened during the Solidarity period and also prior to that, but we very rarely talk about it, and it's actually so relevant. And whenever I think of like lessons at school, like the way it was talked about, it was very dry, just some extensions of the abbreviations that you need to memorize and a few dates, and you don't really talk about it in terms of like the importance ideologically. How did it change over time? And I think honestly, it's very important to bring it back and also see how, and that's another thing I wanted to mention, how interesting it is that a lot of people outside of Poland who are on the left still bring it back and they're like, look at Solidarity. That was a great example of organizing, of workers uniting and like 10 million people in the trade union. What is that? Like, people are so baffled by it, but we don't really have much to say in terms of like actually how did it emerge and how did it happen to change so much over the years so that now we're very neoliberal. That doesn't make any sense.
Growing up in Poland, like, I thought of Solidarity fundamentally as a kind of pro-democracy movement that's also, to a lesser extent, pro-capitalist movement. But it was only when I moved to the UK that I started looking at it as a workers' movement. And that was just not something that really like is visible in Polish political discourse today. But I guess, you know, to explore some of these themes, I think it's important to start from the beginning or even slightly before. Like, what was the political context? What was happening in Poland before Solidarność? What was the government like and who preceded it?
So actually, before I go into that, and it's a great question, since you mentioned how, like, you know, in school, we don't really, we cover Solidarity in a very superficial manner. The way history is being taught in Polish schools is a bit different than in the UK, I mean, as far as I understand. And so we have like one history course that goes throughout the entire education, like primary school, and then we start again at the, you know, we kind of always start with like, at the beginning
times.
Of times, and then we go at a steady pace until like right now. But usually the whole period of, you know, communist Poland and the last 50, 60 years of global history, we don't cover at all, or we cover in like two lessons in total. Whereas like in the US or in the UK, as far as I know, you know, very often you have like specific courses like contemporary history of modern history, like the last 200 years, because we kind of have the sense of this is probably the most relevant. And
for
and in Poland, like, well, what's the most relevant is in the 14th century, there was this king.
You get stuck on the different royals, and then it's like, oh, okay, we've got like 2 hours to cover the war and everything else.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was teaching undergrad at Yale, there are two courses in Central and Eastern European history, and one is, you know, full semester course, Central Eastern Europe from 1918 to now. And kind of, I feel like that would be a much better way of structuring history, because we don't really get any kind of sense about what Solidarity was, what were the political and social circumstances of living in Poland under the Polish United Workers' Party, so in the People's Republic of Poland.
Before we start talking about like the ideology of Solidarność, should we like draw some context? What was the government like in Poland? Were the movement against it? And what led to Solidarność forming?
Right, so Poland after World War II was in the Soviet sphere of influence. The Polish United Workers' Party was governing as a single, as a single party. It was a single party state from roughly 1948. There was a brief kind of Stalinist period until 1953, 54, where we can probably argue that Poland was a totalitarian state, whatever it means. Don't want to go into that debate between like totalitarianism and authoritarianism. And then from 56, there was a relatively big change towards kind of more of a liberalization, more of a, you as citizens can do whatever you want as long as it doesn't interfere with, you know, our position of power and it doesn't really threaten us. And so there was a much higher extent of like, maybe not freedom of press, of course, but at the universities to some extent, you could write whatever you want or read whatever you want. Maybe it's not going to be published, but you're not going to be persecuted for that to a certain extent. And so that's the general context. Poland, single party state, governed by a regime with close ties to the Soviet Union, but still kind of, especially after 56, somewhat independent. And of course, it's a centralized economy. Everything is ruled by the state. Everything other than agriculture is nationalized. So agriculture actually in Poland, it's a big difference compared to other communist countries, was mostly, to a significant extent, was still private. So there were some state state farms, but mostly it was private. And so then, that's the very general kind of political background. And then as it was the case in other communist regimes, there were regular waves of protests starting in 50, actually in 53 a little bit, but then really in 56. Those protests were almost always in response to raising of prices, and they were almost always about the, you know, material conditions of the working class. So the first kind of uprising or wave of protest was 56 in Poznań. It was squashed rather brutally by the regime. Then the next one was 68. It was a bit different. It was a kind of more intellectual, smaller wave of protest.
Around the play.
That was much more about the free speech, but it quickly turned into an anti-Semitic campaign organized by the state. Workers weren't really involved on either side. I mean, the general kind of the myth or the legend is that workers backed the government in huge numbers and kind of participated very eagerly and in large numbers in this anti-Semitic campaign.
Oh yeah, I've seen photos of anti-Semitic rallies.
Right, and those were happening, but to a large extent, it was still a rather small group. And those people were to a large extent mobilized by the party. Although, of course, I don't want to kind of downplay the role of anti-Semitism. The outbursts were real, and people were, you know, purged from universities, from workplaces. A huge number of Polish Jews had to leave the country, and they lost Polish citizenship. But I'm mentioning the fact that, you know, the workers weren't as vehemently in favor of this anti-Semitic campaign, because that myth of, you know, workers' betrayal was very, very important for Polish intellectuals and kind of really influenced the way they were seeing the working class afterwards. And it wasn't really, you know, a huge part of the story. There are, if you look at the number of workers arrested actually in 1968 in protest of the government, you know, treatment of intellectuals, it was pretty high. It was actually, there were more workers arrested than intellectuals, mm-hmm. which makes sense because there's many more workers than mm-hmm. intellectuals, but there were some solidarity protests by the workers, but still relatively limited. Then we have 1970, another wave of huge protests because of the raise in prices of key material goods, and that was taking place in kind of on the Baltic shore and Gdańsk, Gdynia. Then 76 in the industrial cities of Radom and Ursus, which is now part of Warsaw, also again because of the rise in prices. And then we get to 1980, which was kind of the big one again, lowering quality of life and increasing prices, and, you know, workers' revolt against that increasing price.
Yeah, that gives us a good timeline to then, like, maybe dive a bit deeper into what actually has been happening in terms of different fractions of, like, political intellectuals, but also within workers' movement.
And for the benefit of our British listeners and those who did not manage to get to that point in their history classes, can you explain how Solidarity started and what it was?
Right, yeah. So I'll try to do it as briefly as possible. So, you know, on one hand, you know, Solidarity was just like all those previous protests in 56, in 1970, in 1976. So the government, due to economic problems and inefficiency of the state economy, it's raising prices without raising wages, and, you know, tensions build up. But, and that's kind of the way that we usually tell the story, or people who were involved in Solidarity and people who kind of created the story of Solidarity, mm-hmm. the way they tell the story is that 1980 was the year that finally brought workers and intellectuals together. There was this kind of, the way it's also sometimes described is that, like, 1956 and 1968 and 1970 and 1976 were the years of rencontre manquée, so like missed encounters. So the intellectuals and workers couldn't really, you know, participate at the same time because of the, you know, like in 1970s when the workers were protesting, intellectuals were still kind of very much thinking about their betrayal in 1968. So even though workers were being quashed by the government, intellectuals were like, well, actually, we're not going to get involved. And then 76 was the first kind of movement or first moment where the government was quashing brutally, beating up workers in the factory or in industrial cities of Radom and Ursus, and a group of intellectuals called CORE, Committee to the Defense of Workers, organized and offered legal support to those workers, financial material support to their families. And so that was kind of like a first real example of solidarity between between workers and intellectuals. And then, you know, 79, early 80s, you had some kind of more and more ambitious movements towards creating illegal but still trade unions, again, on the Baltic shore in Gdynia and in Gdańsk. There were some independent movements that were trying to create unofficial, you know, or like factory-based trade unions. At the same time, because of the FAO and because of the fact that Poland was kind of, I mean, it was by far the most liberal country in the region in terms of political rights and lack of persecution. And so there was a lot of like bottom up or grassroots courses, like it was called like flying universities. So intellectuals started organizing, you know, courses on economics, on political science, on a lot of like kind of grassroots education. And so when in the summer of 1980, the government raised prices again, and workers in several cities, but mostly Gdańsk, Szczecin, and in Jastrzębie in Silesia started protesting. This quickly became much more than just a localized strike. It kind of spread like wildfire. And the important part was that usually the way the government would handle those things would either quash it with force or would try to come to an agreement with a specific factory or a specific, you know, part of the economy, miners, and we're just going to give something to the miners, and you know, and that should like
do it.
Yeah, that should do it. But in 1980, what the companies were doing, or workers in, like, for example, in the Gdańsk shipyard, they would say, well, we're not going to sign off on any agreement unless you give the same kind of benefits to the shipyard workers in Szczecin and like other workers, public transport workers in Gdańsk, and so on and so on. So it kind of became like a general strike where we're not going to come to any agreement if you're not going to offer that to the entire country, to all the workers.
And the demands at that point were about wages, were they about prices?
So yeah, that's another important factor, because what the government really tried to avoid was to focus really only on material demands without any demands related to, like, again, freedom of speech and
right to organize as well.
Right to organize, political, political prisoners and so on. But what happened was a lot of people who were, you know, active in CORE and active in kind of more of an intellectual side of the opposition, they immediately rushed to the shipyard, both in Szczecin and in Gdańsk, and kind of started to advise the workers, and also kind of linking their demands with the workers' demand, explaining to them that, you know, as long as there's censorship, as long as, you know, they're going to quash your rights to organize and to voice your voice, the fact that you're going to get higher wages right now will mean nothing, you know.
Yeah, demand for free trade unions was the first one, right?
Yeah, and so there were kind of the demands of the kind of newly or kind of still in the process of forming solidarity movement were mostly economic. There were, you know, 21 demands.
Yeah,
21. And like 80% of them were economic, but there were some, and that was very, very important, because it was a huge debate within the kind of growing movement, whether we should include those political demands or we should just say, okay, those political prisoners can stay in prison. We just want our material conditions to be improved. And it was a breakthrough, but, you know, if you just told the workers, well, what about we don't ask for raises and we don't ask for like price controls of basic
free
Saturdays, but we just ask for political rights. I mean, the workers would say no. Sorry, that's not really what matters to us the most.
Yeah, I can't feed my kids. Like, what are you talking about? Yeah. But at that, it's worth saying that at that point it was not about bringing down government. It was not about free and fair elections. Like, no, it was much tougher than that.
No. So it was absolutely not about that. There was a very broad understanding by everyone involved, workers, but also, you know, the intellectual advisors, to solidarity that the experience of Czechoslovakia in 1968, of Hungary in 1956, mm-hmm. clearly shows that, you know, we are in the Soviet sphere of interest, we are in the kind of Soviet bloc. We cannot allow ourselves to have, you know, free and fair elections. Our security fully depends on not kind of going beyond what can be possible, which is also why, you know, the demands were kind of, I mean, they were about improving material conditions and giving some sphere of freedom to organize, you know, as a trade union and kind of have a free press. It was already very, very radical, but they were very, very careful about not, how they frame it.
Because the actual danger was tanks coming and shooting people, right? And that's what they've seen happening in Hungary or, as you say, in Czechoslovakia. So, like, I think it's really important to keep that in mind when we talk about, oh, they should have gone for more or something, because it's very specific for also that period of, like, what is the actual threat and how far. It's like constant balancing of how far we can go, and I guess everyone were aware that's why they preferred to go for those more materials, because they thought this is not going to be so provoking. Mm-hmm. But I guess what is actually quite unbelievable is how that like the perfect storm sort of happened in 1980, and they all started to really like back each other at the same time, and they came up with solidarity with the trade union.
Yeah, how many members did it have at its peak? Because it was absolutely massive.
Yeah, at its peak it had 10 million members, and one of the things that people probably don't know in the most cases is that a lot of those people were also members of the Polish United Workers' Party. So, you know, they felt that as workers, the party that was supposed to represent workers isn't really delivering. So, but they weren't anti-communist. They were, this is 1980. Poland was by then, you know, 30 years under, you know, the rule of Polish United Workers' Party. No one was really yearning for capitalism back then. They, you know, both propaganda, but not only that, kind of the sense that actually, you know, there were huge improvements in terms of education and level of life for a lot of people. So, you know, the Polish People's Republic was incredibly successful in terms of industrializing the Polish economy, bringing people from the countryside to the cities and giving them housing, which wasn't great, but it was still housing and, you know, workable toilets in their apartments. So the material conditions of a lot of like a probably a very, very big part of the Polish society improved dramatically over those 20 years, especially not only compared to the wartime, but also compared to the interwar period.
Mm-hmm. And very much so, industrialized, right?
Right.
That's what happened, because it was a major shift in terms of mainly agricultural country that suddenly became quite industrial.
Yeah, so you know, people were not anti-communist by any margin. They also, another part about, I mentioned security in terms of Soviet Union. It was one, security so that we don't want the Soviet tanks to come, but also Poland had, you know, after World War II, Polish territory shifted much to the west. And so Poland gained a lot of territory that before World War II was German territory. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have, like, a situation on the Polish-German border was not legally guaranteed. So Germany never recognized, West Germany never recognized that this is Polish territory. Mm-hmm. So an argument that was often used by the Communist Party, but not only, also by the opposition, was that, okay, we actually, on one hand, we don't want Soviets to invade, but also Soviet army is probably the only thing that can, you know, help us maintain this territory and actually protect, like, our territorial integrity. So there was the kind of, and the government or the Polish Communist Party was using that a lot as, like, if we are no longer in power, what will stop the kind of imperial, you know, capitalist West from taking your territory, from taking Wrocław, from taking...
When you talk about them, like, not being, like, not opposing communism, might be a good link for us to, like, sort of unpack what communism meant as well in that context and how that ideological debate was playing out, because we obviously know that, like, communism as a term is very
contested.
It's interesting how they were actually very much just Marxist in how they understood communism, and then they were pointing out how
by day, do you mean Solidarność?
Yes, I mean, we didn't mention it, but, like, the open letter to the party, for instance, right? It was, like, a very communist letter, but it was very much pointing out the hypocrisy of the Soviet Union and how it presents itself as communist, but it isn't.
Yeah. Should we explain what the open letter was?
Yeah, we can briefly explain that. Yeah. So we're going back 16 years to 1964. So the open letter was a letter written by two young academic activists, definitely vehemently Marxist, Karol Modzelewski, a historian, and Jacek Kuroń, who was actually also a historian, but much more of an activist, scout activist as well in the scout movement. And they were very influential in this kind of revisionist, younger camp of Polish Marxist intellectuals in the kind of late 50s, early 60s. And they decided to write a political manifesto that was to be distributed among party members. And their hope that was that it's going to be very, very broadly distributed and maybe even start a sort of like a anti-party revolution, so anti-communist party revolution, but revolution by the workers. I mean, the whole point that they were making, which was similar slightly to the point that revisionist Marxists were doing all across Eastern Europe, was that we were supposed to have a government by the workers for the workers, and instead we have a kind of oligarchy of the bureaucrats that kind of replicate the worst sins of capitalism. And so we have the new ruling class is not like industrialists, but it's the bureaucrats.
We highlight this part to any tankies?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a very good read, actually. It was a very kind of in-depth study of the ills of Polish social and economic systems of the day, firmly from a very Marxist perspective. They knew that there's no way this can be positively accepted or like a point of reflection for the party, because they were basically calling for the workers to rise up and bring back deliver what was promised, but without the party that was at the helm. I wonder whether like they were thinking that if actual true Communist Workers' Party comes to power in Poland, then Soviet Union will be fine with that, because ultimately they weren't calling for parliamentary democracy or anything. They were simply calling for the workers to take matters into their own hands. But of course, I mean, it was circulated in like 20 or 30 copies, and they got arrested and they faced trial, and then they were imprisoned for 3.5 years. And but the letter made it to Western Europe and became very, very popular among like a lot of like Western European leftist factions, especially among Trotskyists, but not only. When Daniel Cohn-Bendit was faced trial in 1968, and he was asked about like please name yourself, he said Kuroń Modzelewski. But what was interesting is that in Poland, actually, already in 64, Kuroń and Modzelewski were considered a bit of like oddballs, because they were still believing in Marxist and were using this very kind of materialist Marxist language, whereas most of their peers and like liberal, supposedly Marxist intellectuals in opposition, opposition to the kind of to the current way of doing things within the party, they didn't really believe in that anymore. So even though they were defending Kuroń and Modzelewski and were like protesting for their freedom and defending them in court, they were saying, well, what they wrote was actually like, we didn't believe in that at all. We thought it was completely like too radical and kind of already like written in a language that doesn't apply. We didn't believe in that. But we cannot really not defend like political prisoners. No one should be imprisoned for their beliefs. And so even though those beliefs were bonkers from our perspective, we still have to like stand up for them.
Yeah. So in 1980, when you mentioned like people still thought of themselves as Marxist, it was a kind of attachment to a framework, but without the kind of idealism of the open letter, right? Is that what you're saying?
Very much in like, classic materialist Marxist. Like, so they, no one in 1980, or not no one, but those who were the most influential, prominent intellectuals in 1980 who were backing Solidarity and advising Solidarity, they didn't think that, the end goal should be for a real socialist, workers driven regime. It was
revolution.
More, we have to kind of carve out a space of independent political organizations like trade unions, and that may be like, that will help our situation right now and can lead in some faraway perspective to maybe fully democratizing the system. Mm-hmm. But it was much more about, again, like politics. So even though they weren't like Marxist revolutionaries, they did believe in like command economy to a certain extent, and the fact that states should be very like very involved in providing social rights and you know social welfare to people. So they weren't, there were very few, if any, people who were calling for like, you know, introduction of capitalism in Poland in 1980, not only because of the Soviet threat, but just because, you know, they were very much in this kind of mindset of welfare and equality is much more important than ravages of capitalism and, you know, whoever can get the richest.
Okay, so you've spoken about the influence of Marxism in Solidarność. We spoke about kind of material demands. We spoke about some kind of liberal thinking. But, I mean, there are other factors at play as well, right? Like, for example, what role did Polish nationalism play in the movement?
Right, so nationalism kind of very early on, already in 56, became the calling card of the Communist Party once they kind of realized that, you know, they're probably not going to deliver on the promises of socialist revolution. And so they shifted from this kind of promise of we're on our way to achieving the Marxist socialist dream of universal equality and just very high standard living for everyone. What we promise instead is kind of slow increase, normalcy, and the fact that Poles will be deciding for themselves and kind of nationalism. So in 56, we had a new party chairman and new head of Polish state, essentially Władysław Gomułka, who beforehand was imprisoned for his right-wing deviation and for his nationalist deviation by the country, by the state apparatus. And so Gomułka came and he was like, you know, we won't let Soviets rule us fully. We are, you know, we're going to do like socialism with a Polish face. And then in 68, again, kind of to try to rally society against those revisionist Marxist intellectuals, it was again this, you know, the anti-Semitism of the 1968 campaign was also very much targeted towards that, right? Like, you are being, like, there's this Jewish element that is trying to kind of work against you as workers. And of course, this Jewish element is not Polish, it's probably much more Soviet. So they're the remnants of pre-56, those people, we didn't root them out in 56. And they've been kind of throwing, you know, obstacles at us and kind of depriving Poles of their proper position in the society. And then in the 70s and the 80s, the way the party tried to kind of weaponize nationalism was exactly that question of kind of Germanophobia and protecting Western borders. They were like, you know, because we are so closely linked in a security bloc to the Soviet Union, we, you know, politically we're kind of independent, but like we are part of this military bloc with the Soviets. And if we're not in power, then NATO, you know, can just sweep through Western Poland. And that was a real concern. Like if you talk to anyone from Wrocław or like the kind of Western world, the people were afraid to really like invest in their houses and in everything and like possessions in this Western parts of Poland, because they felt like, you know, at any point we might be like thrown back and we can lose this territory. So on one hand, like the party was using nationalism as a kind of last resort, like, okay, we have no calling cards left, so we're going to play the nationalist card. And they've been doing that since 56. And that also meant that in 1980, you know, in 1981, a lot of workers were also like vehemently anti-Soviet. So they weren't anti, you know, communist or anti-Marxist or anti like social welfare and welfare state or communist state, but they were very much against like the Russians, Soviets, Russians. Yeah, so they're Russophobic for sure. And so that played an important role. Kind of, you know, Catholicism within that played also an important role. Although I'm actually going to backtrack on that. It played some role. I don't think it played an important role.
That's interesting, because obviously that was a time when we had the Polish Pope, and there's still this kind of idea in Poland that's widespread that John Paul II freed Poland from communism,
right,
and churches were kind of considered a bit more a free organizing space, perhaps.
Yeah, so those things are true. But what church actually provided, or what, like, you know, John Paul II's like visits to Poland provided, was this sense of community. So, you know, there were huge, popular
like speeches.
Yeah. So gatherings.
Like,
yeah, so there were huge public gatherings, and that created a sense of actually, you know, we can take to the streets, and we can, you know, there is a sort of kind of societal communitarian feeling, but it was not religious, really. I mean, it was much more about the sense
building
the morale, and the fact that there is some sort of countervailing power to the party, and that we can take to the streets, and we can be, you know, it doesn't have to be the 1st of May where, like, you're forced by your school or by your party apparatchiks in your factory that you have to march on the 1st of May.
Yeah, like every movement community needs its kind of symbolism, its rituals, its sort of kind of driving force.
It's seeing people like not afraid to participate in something that wasn't sanctioned by the party. It wasn't forbidden by the party. Of course, like, the party allowed the Pope to come, and so people, you know, were free to gather. But also the fact that they were free to gather was also like a huge part of, okay, maybe the party isn't as omnipotent as we thought. And also, I mean, just the feeling of, you know, if you ever march as part of a big group in support of any sort of activity, it gives you incredible energy, right?
Yeah.
It's just on a purely physical sense, it gives you this feeling of empowerment. Yeah. So that was one thing. And the other thing is, as you said, church spaces or churches and so on, they were being kind of used as places of gathering. And again, it wasn't religious. It was just that the church was kind of allowing for, you know, opposition intellectuals and workers to use those spaces.
I've heard, like, various people say they didn't particularly believe in God, but, like, they still went to church because that was, like, the thing to do. That was where people gathered. That was where you can, like, speak a bit more openly, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, so in that sense, you know, church was very important as a kind of, sphere of mobilization or space of mobilization. But the clergy and the church hierarchy weren't really, like, supporting solidarity. They were very, very cautious. They, you know, the head of Polish church, I think a couple of days after solidarity was created, didn't really name solidarity or support solidarity. He just said that he's praying for, like, the social unrest in Poland to tone down, and for all the parties to the conflict to find some sort of common agreement for the benefit of the nation. And so he wouldn't be speaking. He was very, very careful about speaking against the party. His name was Cardinal Wyszyński, and he had an ongoing, like, relationship with the party, discussions and so on. And he was saying, I'm not just a cardinal or representative of Solidarity. I am a cardinal representative of the whole Polish nation. So, you know, both the party and everyone else.
I guess the church was also interested in protecting its own space to
be able to
have that, you know, a little freedom.
Yeah, I mean, church, obviously, because of its influential role in Polish history and the fact that Poland was a vehemently Catholic state, was first facing a lot of backlash from the Communist Party, but then both sides kind of realized that they have much more to lose than to gain from continuing this war of attrition. And so church was actually, you know, had a way of ensuring that its interests were protected, and that the communists were not really, the party was not really attacking its interests. And so, I have no doubt that, like, what was in the mind of the hierarchy was that if we side with Solidarity and it backfires, then we can, you know, we're going to be perceived by the government as an anti-systemic force, and we don't want that. And so we're going to play it safe.
We want to play it safe. So in terms of, like, coming back to the timeline so now we are in, like, in the 1980, we have this perfect storm when the Solidarity movement starts to come up. We have the 21
points
that they want to fight for together. And so, can we just speak about, like, a few major figures, also, like, links with symbolic power, and how was, like, Solidarność is a trade union run in terms of what was the actual, like, structure of it?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the person everyone knows as a kind of symbol of solidarity is Lech Wałęsa, and mm-hmm. he was elected as the, you know, president or chairman of the trade union. It wasn't clear that it's going to be him. So he was one of the symbols. He didn't work at the Gdańsk shipyard at the moment of the beginning of the strikes, because he was laid off actually a year before for his activity as a kind of trade unionist. But then when he heard that there's a strike, he jumped over the fence. That's a very kind of symbolic, like we always talk about that. He jumped over the fence of the shipyard and joined the strikers. And he was incredibly charismatic. And so he quickly became one of the leaders of the strike. And so one of the conditions also was to bring him back to work, even though he was laid off more than a year mm-hmm. before. But there were other people who were, you know, just as influential, both in Gdańsk and in the other cities, and also both at the shipyard and outside of the shipyard. One was Anna Valentinovich, who was also working at the shipyard, and she was, you know,
crane driver.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, she was a crane driver. She was laid off in August 1980, and so like the decision to lay her off was one of the major
sparks.
Oh, yeah. And so. For some time, it was quite unclear whether who's going to be the leader of the trade union and whether there's going to be one leader. Many people believed that it should be Valentinovich. Valentinovich herself believed that because she was a woman, she might not be the best choice in a, you know, in a society that was still very and is and is still
patriarchal.
Mm-hmm. And so Wałęsa, kind of as the, you know, second biggest symbol or one of the two biggest symbols, kind of became a leader by default. Also, he really wanted to be the leader. So
yeah, there was still low chance that she would
and in any case, like he you know he was clearly like one of those people who were really gathering a lot of like support, and he had a flair for the dramatic, you know, whenever like he was negotiating with the government, he would always come out with something that was kind of like ridiculous. Like he would have this huge pen when he was signing the agreements, ridiculously huge pen, and so he uses those like weird puns and sayings that are very kind of memorable,
and that definitely makes the crowd sort of okay, like look at that. He's just badass.
He's the kind of guy who, like, when he talks to the government representatives, you feel like he has no fear and he doesn't treat them like very seriously or like with a lot of respect. Mm-hmm. And so, that was definitely part of his charm. At the same time, you know, Wałęsa wasn't particularly. Well, he was politically savvy in some sense of like as a political operator, but he wasn't someone who had very clear beliefs or like knowledge mm-hmm. of, you know, economy or political science or anything. So he really relied on those advisors, but he was also hard-headed. So whenever, you know, he disagreed with the advisors, he was kind of very open to like, okay, now I'm going to listen to other advisors because I don't like what those advisors are saying. So he was, you know, when you have this like someone can be chaotic evil, chaotic good, or just chaotic, and kind of Wałęsa is chaotic. Like he's, you know, and so which was also part of the problem in the sense of like everyone was trying to influence him. They never really quite knew what
where
he's gonna
going
to go to, whether he's going to be too radical or not radical enough. But mm-hmm. he was the, you know, one person that could like still convince workers across the entirety of Solidarity. I mean, he had enemies, of course, but for the kind of the foot soldiers of the trade union, he quickly became the symbol that mm-hmm. that was able to like keep this whole movement together. Mm-hmm. A movement that was, you know, very grassroots. At, you know, they were in every factory. They were organized by regions, so not by sectors of the industry. And so every kind of factory would send delegates to the regional meeting of the trade union, and then they would send the national delegates and so on. And Wałęsa was someone who, you know, whenever there was a flare-up in a particular factory or a strike in a particular factory, and there was a feeling that this can go wrong and this can create like a situation where the party will use violence or the situation will get out of control, he would just go to that factory and talk to the workers and talk to the, you know, to the party and kind of be this guy who mediate and kind of use his authority and his charisma to kind of put things back to bring stability back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he was basically like members of Solidarność. They felt like he's the right representative for them, and they sort of trusted him in making those decisions as well. But I think it's really interesting how they also had all these meetings and all these discussions about how to take it, and how it was driven from bottom up in so many ways. And I think, you know, this also brings to mind the question of, like, how do you navigate those different sides of having this sort of political movement in terms of, like, rank and file, which should be and is, in this case, I think, the basis of the whole thing, because you can't do anything without the rank and file, without those members that work at the bottom. But then you have also those intellectuals, those leaders of the trade union, so more of a bureaucratic role, but at the same time representative role of those workers. And then you have those intellectuals who are also trying to be the advisors and steer it in the right direction. And I'm just wondering how, yeah, like, I mean, it's very difficult to summarize, but how all of that played out and also changed, because we are still, like, sort of talking of the beginnings of 1980, but we know that when the martial law happened in 1981, things started to change very dramatically. And
so we have Solidarność winning the right to organize, right, in 1980, but then soon afterwards being very brutally crushed, right?
Yeah, and this whole period between, like, August 1980 and then the martial law of December 1981 it was a slow march towards a much more kind of centralized, much more, much less democratic. So it kind of became more of a, leader-driven movement because of this idea that if we just leave the rank and file to decide, they're going to push for radical economic agenda that is purely impossible to enact, and also would be counterproductive, would only increase the crisis.
And can you now explain maybe what the martial law was? Because I feel like it's commemorated in Poland even, well, more than the birth of Solidarność, right? I think, like, everyone knows the date, like December 30th.
Absolutely.
Can you explain what it was?
It was a decision to, essentially enact a kind of military form of government. It wasn't a kind of coup d'etat. I mean, you can almost see it as a coup d'etat. I don't think it was a state coup, but it was just a violent restriction of already limited civic and human rights. Members, like prominent members of Solidarity, were either imprisoned or interned. Wałęsa was interned. Many others, Michnik and so on, they were imprisoned. There was an absolute, like, ban on assembling, freedom of press was quashed, censorship kind of came back. Any protests, especially at the early stage, there were protests in the coal mines by miners, and there was this violent altercation which in Kopalnia Wujek that a lot of I don't remember the exact number, but
I think 9 miners were killed.
Yeah. It was a very swift kind of military security operation where, people were, there was a curfew and so on. People were just, like, had to stay in houses. There was an informational kind of, it was a media kind of ban. You know, it's very, very difficult to get any sort of information about what's happening. And the Polish opposition wasn't really, like, I mean, the Solidarity movement wasn't ready for that at all. They were taken by surprise fully. And so the martial law was very actually successful in kind of destroying the Solidarity movement, just because no one prepared for that scenario to that extent. They didn't expect that to happen at that moment. Next time Solidarity was legal was already kind of in the midst of 1989 and the elections and so on, so
it was a very different
but actually in the kind of 88-89 there was another huge wave of strikes, and that kind of started the that was the spark for the roundtable discussions and agreement. But that, like, those who were protesting in 1988 and 1989 were not people who were actually involved in Solidarity in 1980. Those were, like, young workers who were, like, 20, 21 in 88. So for them, like, Solidarity, they were, like, 12 when Solidarity was happening.
Right, so there isn't this, like, straightforward continuity now.
No, if anything, like, members or like influential members of Solidarity in 88, in 89, if they were involved, they were involved in like kind of speaking to those workers, to those young workers, saying, you have to like back down, you have to like lower your expectations, you can't really risk like, because it's going to be martial law again if you don't take a step back. So they were, you know, Wałęsa was using his authority to kind of tell them to take a step back.
So I think that already gives us a bigger picture how those ideological influences also started to shape and what actually took a bigger prominence and then how it developed. Because, I mean, you know, if I put my Marxist hat on, I can definitely like, it seems like 1980 was a breakthrough in terms of like you actually have a legal trade union that has independent committees and that works really like is an actual threat for the party and is an actual threat maybe to like a whole block in a way, because if Solidarity, you know, this is obviously just talking like very that scenario that never happened, but if it won at that time, if it actually decided to overturn the government, which some argue they had the power to do with that many workers backing them up, you know, that could be the end of it. And that's still when we have a lot of people like sort of wanting a communist state, but in those terms that we that are closer to the open letter. I mean, probably there, but still this sort of spirit. Whereas when we actually like with the martial law, we have this moment of completely quashing it, changing the movement totally and absolutely like killing off the spark that was there. And then it comes back years later, but it's not the same movement and it already has a very different ideological thing at its core. It's more about, okay, now we have to, there's a bigger chance of actually having a democratic state. We already see that Soviet bloc is very weak. We are not as scared as we were back then, but this is the time to actually be realistic now and to really, you know, don't like, let's not bring back those Marxist ideas in. We want to divide the power between the people who are responsible enough to like handle it. And we're going to introduce this and this, and workers are sort of sidelined, right?
Yeah, and I guess the question now is like, at what point does neoliberalism come in, and how? Because obviously, the transformation in Poland, right, the government that was formed afterwards was quite a brutally neoliberal one,
absolutely,
right? Not a moderate one whatsoever, right? So how did something that like, you know, in the early 80s was still Marxist influence become that?
Yeah, so I mean, it goes back to this idea, to the role that Solidarity kind of leadership started to play in 1980, where, you know, they, in a way, the government or the Polish, the Polish United Workers' Party outsourced kind of dealing with the economic problems to the leadership of Solidarity. So instead of them being a trade union representing the interests of workers, they were supposed to be the ones who, you know, persuade the workers that, oh, this can be done, this can be done, this can be done. So like, maybe we can ask for that for the government, but anything else will be unrealistic. So when the martial law came and, you know, the Solidarity as this massive movement was completely destroyed, those people who were then representing Solidarity as the time kind of went by closer to 89, 88, 87, were those people who were at the head of Solidarity, or especially they were like the intellectual advisors to Solidarity. So those people would then be representatives of Solidarity, and they would be seen as, for many like former members of Solidarity, for many workers, they would be seen as legitimately like representative of Solidarity, but they had no like large like concrete backing. The whole idea was like, okay, we represent Solidarity, and then society is like, yeah, they actually do, I guess I buy that, you know, for the most part. Yeah, I remember them as being influential in Solidarity, but they didn't have any sort of mandate other than the government saying, well, we're gonna negotiate with you because you represent Solidarity. And it was mostly because, well, Wałęsa was part of that, and Wałęsa was such a huge symbol of Solidarność movement for everyone, that the fact that the government was negotiating with Wałęsa would be like enough for most members of Solidarity, the old members, to say, yeah, that's true, he speaks for us. But in 89, the situation kind of came back in the same way of, okay, we have an even bigger economic crisis right now. You know, we are really on the brink of a bankruptcy. We need to enact like pretty hardcore reforms to get us back on track. And we as the Polish United Workers' Party are in no position to do that. And so what are we going to do? We're going to kind of co-opt the opposition so that we share power with them to some extent. I mean, the original idea was to have one third of the members of the parliament to be from Solidarity. Mm-hmm. And so it was just like, we're going to co-opt them, and then they're going to be the ones who will be defending the economic policy of kind of market reforms that will increase unemployment and decrease the quality of life for many people. They will be the ones who will be persuading the workers that this has to be done. And then, you know, the events went in a direction that the party was completely swept in the partially free elections. So they lost every single seat that they could. So the one third of seats in the parliament, they were competing for them. They lost all of them. There was the creation of an independent Senate with 100 seats, and the Solidarity Movement gained 99 of them. And one was won by an independent guy who was just like a, you know, very rich member of his small community, and everyone voted for him because he was employing everyone. So kind of, but none of the members of the, you know, Party of the United Workers of Poland, Polish United Workers Party, made it to the Senate. So it was an absolute massive electoral collapse. And so at this point, it became clear that Solidarity, you know, if we want to enact those reforms, they really have legitimacy or social backing. And so at first, the communist regime tried to still form a government and, you know, be at the head of the government, but they failed. And this is a big story about, like, it was, you know, the Polish United Workers Party had like two satellite parties that were sitting in the parliament, and they were supposedly independent, and one was kind of more rural and the other one was kind of more like a Christian Democrats. Obviously they were both like they were both like puppet parties until 89, where they realized, actually, you know, if we side with those like one third of the parliament that is from Solidarity, we will actually have the majority. And so then that became kind of this destabilizing factor. But at the end of the day, the ruling coalition under Solidarity-backed Tadeusz Mazowiecki, who became prime minister in 1999, was backed both by the Polish United Workers Party and Solidarity. Mm-hmm. But by that time, like Solidarity, or like those, we say Solidarity as if it's the trade movement. It wasn't the trade union. It was the intellectuals and kind of leaders of Solidarity from 10 years ago who were like, okay, this country is in a huge economic crisis and we have to act fast. And what we're getting is a lot of civil and democratic and political freedoms, but we also have to clean up this mess. And then you have advisors.
I mean, like late 80s internationally, like neoliberalism was already very entrenched.
Right. So you have Jeffrey Sachs coming, who, you know, straight from Latin America, where he was advising Latin American governments on how to crash inflation with, like, you know, institutional reforms that were basically just, shock therapy market reforms that were really, essentially aimed at increasing unemployment so that you lower inflation. I mean, the best way to fight inflation is to cause massive unemployment. Actually, it isn't, as we discovered in Poland, because what we ended up having through 90s was very, very high level of unemployment and very, very high level of inflation. That's a different economic conversation. What also apparently happens is if you fire everyone, then there's very few companies that produce things. And so even though the demand is falling, people still have to eat. And there's fewer companies that produce what people need, and so the prices are going up even though everyone is unemployed, because you have to give people some sort of social welfare. And so we had massive unemployment, and the first time inflation fell under 10% in Poland was 10 years after 1989.
I'd love to do an episode about like the 90s and transformation in Poland, because that is fascinating. But since we've been going for over an hour, I guess it's time to like come back to the big questions about the legacy of Solidarność, right? So we kind of mentioned that nearly every side of Polish politics tries to claim Solidarność for itself. Who do you think has the best claim?
No one. Wow. No, I mean, absolutely no one. Because you have, the Polish left, the young left that has none of the people who are actually part of Solidarity, they have the best claim because they have the kind of ideological
tradition.
They support the same kind of political program or the political program that's the closest to what Solidarity stood for, which was, you know, if we tone it down a little bit, Solidarity, of course, in 1980 was operating within a communist or, you know, state-controlled economy fully, and with a 40 years tradition of living in a single party state, so they were not social democrats. But within the kind of realms of democracy, they would be the closest to, well, we want a welfare state where we have, you know, housing, we have affordable schools, hospitals, fair wages, we can afford like basic necessities, and we can, you know, literally like Western European welfare state. So yeah, there's only one party that represents that, and that's Partia Razem. As for Law and Justice and Platforma Obywatelska, well, Law and Justice has definitely this element of nationalist, kind of chauvinist core that in equal, I mean, I would say it represents more of the Polish United Workers Party, the way they were actually handling their business through like 56 to 89, which, well, we will defend Polishness, like we crush your rights here and there, and we offer some sort of welfare, but not much, but we defend Polishness and we stand for Polishness and like the sovereignty of Polish state. That was literally what, you know, Gomułka and Gierek and Jaruzelski were saying. Jaruzelski introduced martial law to defend Poland, right, against like Soviet invasion.
So again, that also very, very familiar narrative of a threat that is attacking us like from either side, and you have to defend yourself, and therefore
Law and Justice, and then Civic Platform and Tusk and like the, you know, liberal milieu like Estefa Borcza Michnik, what their claim is, well, solidarity as like the entire story and history of Polish dissidents and Polish opposition to the communism, it wasn't opposition to communism or like to authoritarianism or whatever, was about political rights, civic rights, about enlightenment, about, you know, the fact that also independence and patriotism, but not nationalism. We were kind of, we were against the party first because they were quashing like civil liberties and human rights, and second because they were xenophobic, like rampant nationalist, and we stand for a more kind of classically patriotic pro-European Poland. But what they actually stand for is this very, but there, you know, there's no component whatsoever here of any kind of social rights or welfare state or social services. That's one. And the other thing is, it has this very strong component of classist and kind of anti-popular politics, right? Because it's, well, what the party was doing was like rising up this, like, Polish people are very easily riled up in this nationalistic fervor, and so
very much like paternalistic approach.
So it's an incredibly paternalistic approach that kind of we can see for the last 30 years. I can give you some like choice quotes of Michnik. So in 1990 he said that what we see, right, you know, 1 year after like the beginning of the transition towards democracy, when people were complaining about the reforms and the unemployment was skyrocketing, and you know, the situation, the economic situation was horrible, and so there were more and more voices of like discontent. He said that what we see right now is like the classic example of like Polish, Polish, like very pejorative term for for simple people, or I can't really think of it. Dupes, or, you know, just like fools, or like idiots, like raising their ugly head, and like chamstwo. So like
has kind connotation, like being from the countryside, being uneducated.
So like it rears its ugly head again, and then, you know, that's 1990. 2007, after like Law and Justice lost, there was this 2 year period of Law and Justice in power, Michnik said, well, every, criticizing the fact that Poles selected Law and Justice, he said, well, every country has kind of the intelligentsia that it deserves, although I would argue that Poland has a better intelligentsia than like the Polish nation deserves. And so, yeah, so it's an incredibly paternalistic. So one thing that really interests me in terms of kind of neoliberal link between kind of this democratic elitism and actually like saying, well, the elites know better, knows what's best for the people. Therefore, like, yeah, you hate shock therapy, but this is all for your benefit. Mm-hmm. And so shut up, you know, it's going to trickle down at some point. You're going to be fine. Yeah. But there's also this idea of, you know, the fact that in Poland, we only compliment and we only cherish entrepreneurs and kind of people who own companies is because they showed like the necessary maturity, right? They proved on the market that they can be responsible and self-sufficient and create something.
The meritocratic dream of you get what you deserve, because if you just work hard, you will get there. But obviously, like, completely discarding any barriers, societal barriers whatsoever, any class.
But not even that, because if you have like a small entrepreneur who has like a business of two people and it's a car wash or whatever, and that person can earn very little money and not be particularly successful, because a lot of small businesses are not particularly successful for obvious reasons. But that person will be like treated as a hero by the Polish narrative, or like, oh, he took, you know, he is not a Homo Sovieticus, because he doesn't wait for someone to give him something or someone to create a a job for him. He is and
proactive, takes things.
He is like, there's this confluation of like civil society in Poland essentially means someone who participates in the market in a way that's like running a company. Whereas if someone is a worker, and you can be a worker for, like Mercedes and be super productive from the perspective of like productivity levels and so on, and earn much more than that guy who's running his own company, but you're going to be workers. So like, yeah, you cannot unionize, because like unions are just, very detrimental to the economy, because what workers want is to destroy the economy, just to take and take. They have no conception of public good and like the general order. Entrepreneurs, they act with society in mind, with like the
they want to deliver something.
Yeah, they don't think about themselves, or even if they think about themselves, what they do is actually like make it better for everyone.
Yeah,
I honestly don't know how we got here from
this way. So
I mean,
so
that's
hard.
The legacy of solidarity in Poland. I cannot give you like a better legacy. Is that we have no respect for workers or for trade unions whatsoever. Trade union is a fucking pejorative. Sorry, can I swear? Okay, trade union is a pejorative word in Poland with horrible connotations. Entrepreneur is like the apex
backbone
of you can apex
society.
Of you can achieve. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so hard to talk about like the working class or workers' rights, because any self-respecting worker is just a temporary embarrassed entrepreneur.
Exactly.
That's very well said. And also it's cool, like we don't teach workers' rights, but we have przedsiębiorczość, which is like
entrepreneurship.
Principles of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Or
like, we have to like write business plans as teenagers. I hate this.
Yeah.
So it's very much ingrained. So again, we need to like probably mention that it didn't just come up on its own. Like that was the narrative that we received from those elites that came after the party, right?
That was the exact message. Yeah, those people who were saying there's no freedom without solidarity, and that was one of the biggest like slogans of solidarity in 1980. I mean, then they were essentially, you can then say, well, there's also no freedom with solidarity once we have freedom. So we need solidarity as a trade movement to kind of have the critical mass of people to bring political change. But once we brought this political change, we cannot really maintain freedom as long as the trade unions are running the show, because they're irresponsible. They're, thinking only about themselves. And so to protect our, the gains that we got from those workers, we have to like, it's in their best interest if we deprive them of any sort of political and economic power and enact reforms against their interests. And
And if you listen to our episode about trade unions in the last season, like, Solidarność, what's calling itself Solidarność now is actually like one of the most right-wing ones, right?
It's both
like socially conservative and economically very compromising.
Yeah.
And I mean, we didn't mention, but we have to say Balcerowicz is the one who was leading that that sort of narrative as well towards, like as you said, a shock therapy in terms of how we should run the economy. And I think, what is also quite remarkable is that it was like literally one of the most neoliberal policies that you've seen anywhere. Like,
yeah, I mean, very, very briefly. Yes, Poland like embraced a very, very, very radical kind of way of transitioning towards free market, much more radical than almost any country in the region. It was called shock therapy for a reason. There was also this metaphor that I like. It was like jumping headfirst to an empty swimming pool. There was no interest or no understanding that, there are different forms of capitalism, there are different forms of market economies in Europe and everywhere else. What we took was like a very kind of caricature version of free market or market economy. One of my favorite anecdotes, and that's going to be a very short one, is when we were negotiating with IMF on like the debt relief and restructuring program. Whenever IMF, you know, there's this myth in Poland that it's all, one of the myths is like, well, Balcerowicz was actually meaningless, everyone was meaningless because IMF just like pushed through, we had no agency whatsoever, what, you know, the shape of reforms was purely coming from IMF. Well, when we were negotiating with IMF, IMF sometimes like gives you a couple of scenarios. Okay, so this scenario is, okay, you're going to do this, and then the inflation is going to be, you know, 120%, and if you're going to do this, it's going to be 100%, and blah, blah, blah. But of course, there are social costs to all of those. And the Polish negotiators were always like picking the most radical version. Like, even, and there are memories of like, there are memoirs of IMF negotiators who were like, they were picking the most radical version, and then they were asking like, can we go more radical? Mm-hmm. And so IMF was creating a much bigger margin for us to have a, not soft landing, soft landing was impossible, but kind of have more of a gradual thing. And we just always embraced the most radical because we bought in, we were like, okay, if this works, if neoliberalism and Washington consensus and trickle-down economy works, then why we should, you know, do half measures? Like, we want to be the best student in class.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and of course, it didn't work out. That's, you know, we can have a whole other podcast about economic policy.
But
that's kind of, so Balcerowicz for me, you know, he was obviously very influential just as a figurehead.
Yeah.
But it's not that, you know,
he just reflected.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
And he executed what was already there.
He was a ruthless operator. In that sense, he was very, very good.
Yeah,
I mean,
I guess,
bad, but
I guess that's where we have to wrap up.
I
know we could go on for a very long time, but that was incredibly informative and very interesting.
And depressing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what we definitely can gather from what we've talked about is that there was a quite remarkable mobilization amongst the workers, and there was an unprecedented trade union movement, the biggest in the world, that came together at the time where it shouldn't have, really. There were no basis for it to come up, and it still managed to be legitimately accepted by the government. But then very quickly, I think when also the party realized what they've let happen, like what they allowed to happen, they've just decided to quash it, and then we have martial law, and that we have a complete turn in terms of like where the thought and where the direction went. I guess, you know, it definitely, there are some lessons. There are some lessons in terms of like what can we take from that, and I think, you know, the paternalistic approach really proves to be the problem, and also that constant, we should be the realists. We should also always go for this option that is the most reasonable, whereas what's reasonable often needs to be also challenged, right?
Yeah. So if my only lesson would be, if you're a trade union, if you are a social movement that represents your interests, represent your interests. Don't let anyone tell you that you have to compromise, like to present a more of a compromise position. That's the point of negotiations. Like, you always stick to your guns, and then when you negotiate, you can then, you know, come up with a compromise. But you should never preemptively say, well, this is too radical, because the other side is never going to do that. As workers, as activists, or as climate activists, whoever, you have to present and defend your interests.
Yeah, you've managed to end on a surprisingly inspiring note, so thank you for that. If people want to follow your work, because obviously you write and talk not only about Solidarność and history, but also what's happening in politics today, where can people follow you?
So on Instagram, my Instagram name is, handle is milos.między.innymi. And then I also write a Substack. I have a couple of articles in English, but mostly it's in Polish. So it's Wiatrowski, one of my last names, .substack.com. I'm also on Twitter, where you can probably find me with my last name. So that's basically it. Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.